Hello, welcome to this week's Open and Bell, the Boxing News Podcast. I'm editor Tris Dixon, joined for the umpteenth successive week by Matt Christie. Matt, how's it going?
Yeah, it's going good. It's going
good. We've got a little run going here, haven't we?
We have, yeah.
Enjoying it?
Yeah, it's good.
And poor John, desperate to regale his war stories from Macau, has been delayed by a good week or so. In fact, you know what? We might even do a Macau special at the start of next week.
Yeah, that would make
Maybe
sense.
Maybe we should do that.
It makes sense.
We'll try not to leave him in the wilderness.
Yeah.
In Macau, now he's back. So anyway, that was last week. We can talk about that a little bit in a minute, but very excited for this weekend's fights. In particular, Billy Joe Saunders, Chris Eubank Jr. Matt, is that the pick of the weekend's fights and the bill in London for you?
For me, it's perhaps the pick of the year's fights. I am really, really looking forward to this contest. Really looking forward to it.
If it wasn't Chris Eubank Jr. and just another fighter who'd had the same fights, and albeit you had the same stories about sparring from, if it wasn't Chris Eubank, if he didn't have that name, what kind of, how good's that fight still?
It would still be an interesting fight with the amount of promise around the fighter, but you can't deny the fact that he is Chris Eubank's son adds so many layers to this tale. And you know, the fact is that more than likely he, because with what you've got with when you've got a prospect like this, a highly touted prospect, is lots and lots of question marks. How are they going to cope when they go past six rounds? What is their jaw like? We've got clues to the answers of those questions because we know how Eubank was in terms of he had a granite chin, so therefore we're almost presuming that Eubank Jr. will as well. You know, it's all in the genetics, but to me, fascinating, brilliant, can't wait.
The bookmakers are saying that this fight has caught the attention of the gambling fraternity more so than the Fury-Chisora fight. Just tweeted some stuff from William Hill, who say they've had a £35,000 bet on Billy Joe Saunders winning, and they've also taken a £10,000 bet on Eubank Jr. winning. So there's a lot of money on the line, a lot of money at stake, and some very confident bettors out there, which is surprising because although on paper, you know, you have to go with Billy Joe Saunders based on the level he's been fighting at and his amateur pedigree, you know, that you put it all into a mix and you come down sort of on either side of the fence, don't you?
Yeah, it's...
Or on the fence even.
Well, it's just poised, isn't it? It's poised, there's that intrigue around Eubank Jr. And from the moment this fight was signed, which I believe was in September, the confident words from Eubank's camp, from his father, from his trainer, from the fighter himself, there's an absolutely no doubt in those words. It's not just talk, you feel that confidence. It's not just for the sake of marketing the fight. And from when this was made, my first instinct was, well, if they lose this, there's going to be so much egg on their face because of what they've been saying, which makes you then think, well, surely they're absolutely 100% certain they're going to win this fight.
Well, I think also what they can take, I'd say, to the bank is you can see that Chris Eubank Jr. is a warrior. You can see it. It's almost like he's got... It's almost like with how he carries himself, you know that even if he's getting boxed, outboxed and bewildered, he will still be coming. He's that sort of guy who will try and bully you, who will try and walk you down. I think he's obviously got a lot on his shoulders with regards to being Chris Eubank Jr. And being the son of the father and all the rest of it. So I think either way they can be certain about is that Junior will be committed 100% all the way through 12 rounds of a fight. And I think maybe that's what they're so sure about, is even if they lose, they will have respect because they've gone into a fight as big underdogs. A lot is expected of him now because of the hype around the fight and because of his name, But technically, there shouldn't be any great expectations on him. And so even if it, even if he doesn't win, the fact that he's taken this massive leap of faith to fight Saunders, I think he will come out of the fight with a lot of credit, win, lose, or even a draw.
Mm.
And that's probably what they're so certain about. And when you look at Chris Eubank's defeats, he arguably, certainly later in his career, he got more from defeat than he ever did in victory. And maybe that's what they're looking at Junior. And regardless, you can see obviously Chris Eubank Junior, through his amateur career, he was sort of fast-tracked in terms of moved into sparring with world-class fighters ahead of his time when he was out in America with the likes of Chad Dawson and so on. Maybe that's what they're doing. Maybe they think, even if in defeat, in 12 rounds with Billy Joe Saunders, we'll teach him more than 3 years of fighting the guys he's been fighting.
Wise words, Tris.
Thanks, mate. I've been working on it for, you know, 20 years. but the odds, let's have the odds. So basically, you can get Billy Joe Saunders is averaging about 4-5 on as the favourite, and Eubank, a slight underdog, 11-10. You can get 6-5 with the draw at 25-1. Is that fair? I mean, would you? I believe Eubank's odds have come in to be 6-5. Do you think that's reasonable, or do you think it's just because the amount of money that is that?
The money will have an effect on the odds. Yeah, definitely. But I think it's not quite a pick'em fight, is it? It's not quite...
It shouldn't be.
No, and I don't think it is 50-50. There's something on our website where 25 experts were polled, and not many, I can't remember the exact number, but I'm pretty sure it was less than 5 picked Eubank Jr.
Which is funny, because we're getting all these a lot of people are saying what a great bill it is, and I'm not knocking the bill for 1 minute, because obviously I'm very excited to see Saunders Eubank, very excited to see Fury Chisora, but I think another boxing magazine had a poll of 30 people picking for Fury and Chisora recently, and I think only 5 picked Chisora. And like you say, similar amount now picking, or similar ratio picking Eubank to beat Saunders. And I think probably you'd have it even more than that picking Gavin to beat Bradley Skeet. So, I mean, look, they're all good matches. Like I said, I'm not knocking it for one moment, but you know, that when you see those stats, it kind of makes you think, doesn't it? It does make you think, well, maybe it's not the 50-50 fight that we're led to believe. But I think, obviously, with the Saunders-Eubank thing, you mix all the unknown into the pot, and you just don't know, do you? And I mean, I, for one, having seen and been to a couple of the press conferences, obviously looking forward to going to the weigh-in later, but I'm not sure that Chris Eubank Jr. isn't in Billy Joe's head a little bit too much. And I mean, you could see during the press conference the other day when they were talking about Billy Joe Saunders retiring if he didn't beat him in 5 rounds. You know, there was a little bit of backtracking from Team Saunders going on there. And obviously, fair enough, because that's proper fighting talk, isn't it? You know, to say that you'll retire if you don't beat someone in 5 rounds. But, it doesn't look great if you're sort of backing down on this sort of stuff so close to the fight time.
No, I mean, initially, I think during the no-shows when Eubank Jr. was not there for some of the early press conferences, Billy Joe Saunders really seemed completely unperturbed. He wasn't concerned. It didn't seem like Eubank Jr. was in his head in a negative way. But certainly at that press conference on Monday, it appeared to me that first time that they were together, Eubank came out on top of that little battle on Monday. And some of the things that Eubank was saying kind of did certainly scream naivety. But also something that kind of stuck in my head was that, yes, Billy Joe is saying all those things, like, yeah, if I don't stop you in 5 or 6 rounds, I swear on my kid's life, I'm going to retire. things like that, which are probably ill-judged statements to make. But what he said as well, he said, when I beat you, I'm going to scream about it on social media, I'm going to tell everybody that I've beaten you and this, that and the other. And Eubank Jr. just turned to him and said, well, that's where you and I are different, because when I've beaten you, I'm just going to move on. You won't be in my mind at all. And it's that it's that intensity about Eubank.
Yeah.
That is
he
really
sees Billy Joe as a stepping stone.
Yeah, and it's fascinating. Going back to what you were saying about the experts kind of picking Saunders, it is one of those fights where logic tells you really, really have to pick Billy Joe Saunders, because Eubank Jr. hasn't been in with anybody like that. But it's almost to pick where you say, okay, I'll pick Billy Joe Saunders, but it wouldn't surprise me if Eubank Jr. wins. And I think that's slightly different to when people are saying, okay, I think Fury will win, and people are pretty convinced by that. Yeah. There's no real, oh, but I wouldn't be surprised if Chisora win. It would be a huge surprise, I think, ultimately, if Chisora won.
Where's the mystique from Eubank come from? Has it come from the sparring stories that we've heard over the years from the likes of Froch, from America, from Cleverly, from Groves? Remember a year or two ago, there was a big sort of bust up with De Gale and his gym as well. Has it come from those sparring stories? Has it come from the potentially shown in the ring? Does it come from the name and the imagery of the father? I mean, where's this mystique come from? Because you're looking at a guy who's got one of the most padded records in world boxing today.
Yeah, and this is the thing. I mean, for a while before, I mean, the Billy Joe Saunders fight was being rumoured, and there was various step-ups for Eubank Jr. which were being rumoured. None of them were taken. And I just thought they're moving this guy along, and yeah, like you say, they're just padding his record, and maybe they're hoping for a massive payday. I can't imagine this is the huge retirement payday that they were talking about. So yeah, for a while I did think, well, yeah, they know something, that he's not ready for that step up. But I don't know, I remember being, I was ringside for his professional debut, and it was bizarre, and at that point I was fascinated, I was hooked. Just from that professional debut, he stopped some guy, I think, in very early on. But seeing Eubank Jr. in the gold trunks, leaping over the ropes, exactly like his father did, very, very similar mannerisms. Different way of fighting, but very similar mannerisms in the ring. Ronnie Davis was there as well.
The music.
And it was just all it was. It was just like, crikey, we've gone back in time here. But you were fascinated then to see how that journey progresses and where it ends up. And we are in the midst of that journey. But let's not forget here, there's a nagging voice at the back of my mind almost saying it's written in the stars that Eubank is going to win this fight, that he's going to go on. But also, in 48 hours' time, that journey that I speak of could be finished. If Saunders wins emphatically, who's Billy Chris Eubank Jr. will probably have been exposed, and the interest is almost gone overnight.
So that Golovkin fight will just disappear into thin air.
I would say so, yeah.
I mean, because Chris Eubank Jr., who obviously isn't a stranger to hyping fights, has been saying again that his son's the most dangerous human being on the planet, and that he's better than Golovkin.
Yes, it's a ludicrous.
But you say it's ludicrous, but again, with the mystique, you just don't know, do you?
Well, no, exactly. I mean,
you do know, but you don't know.
Thing is, there wouldn't be, if it was, say, Eubank Jr. versus Golovkin tomorrow, I'm pretty sure we wouldn't have, yeah, well, Golovkin will probably win, but it wouldn't surprise me if Eubank Jr. did. There's a feature in this week's magazine with Ronnie Davis. I kind of put that to him about the whole Gennady Golovkin comment, and, you know, his reaction was a snigger and what have you. About the whole Golovkin comment, but what he did say is that you can guarantee that Eubank Senior is saying those things because he believes them. He genuinely believes his son is the best fighter on the planet in those weight categories.
Plural.
Well, he said it himself, hasn't he? He said did he say middleweight to light heavyweight? Yeah. There's no one that can beat my son.
Yeah. So there's some decent fighters.
Kovalev.
Yeah.
Kovalev, Andre Ward.
Cotto.
Yeah.
Well, he'd walk through Cotto.
Yeah, of course he would. Of course he would smash him up.
And Canelo in the same night.
Yeah, and if Mayweather stepped up, I'm sure he'd school him as well.
Well, let's not go down that road. But yeah, I mean, that's the fight that can legitimise Mayweather's record.
That would absolutely cement his legacy.
Yeah,
okay. But does he not remind you a little bit, and I know this has been said before, but the whole thing as well that's fascinating is it does hark back to Nigel Benn, Chris Eubank 1.
Yeah.
It really
does. Well,
that's
one of the things I was going to say, actually, and not only that, but this is a fight where you can think, you know, providing what you said earlier doesn't happen, providing Eubank Jr. isn't taken to school and massively outclassed, you know, there could be two or three fights in this.
Yeah.
There could be. And, yeah. You know, because if Eubank struggles but wins, or if it's a struggle in any way, shape or form, it's obviously it's being billed as a WBO world title eliminator. So they're at that level where they're not going to go much higher. So if the best deals are to be made with them fighting each other to continue the bad blood, then so be it. You know, we've seen it before, and obviously Chris Eubank Senior wasn't averse to a rematch.
Yeah.
And I don't think Junior would be either. But again, obviously it's business, isn't it? It's a business decision.
Yeah.
And it will come down to everyone, because obviously it's been well documented that Frank Warren at Box Nation hasn't really enjoyed working with Chris Eubank Senior this time, so it depends on if it's all worth it for everyone involved.
I think it will be, won't it? I think money ultimately will talk. Another aside to this is the whole Ronnie Davis versus Jimmy Tibbs thing.
Which is great, isn't it?
Great story. I think this will be the sixth time that they've been in the opposite corners as part of the team, and so far Tibbs hasn't won any of those.
That's fascinating. Great stat. And I mean, I must say that your piece on Ronnie Davis is brilliant. I've sort of seen people complimenting you on it.
I enjoyed writing it.
And then we've got the big previews in the magazine this week as well. So Danny Flexen on the big two plus the undercard. And then there's also in Heroes and Villains our takes on who might win the big fights this weekend. I've got to say I'm torn. I think I just don't know. There is obviously this X factor about Eubank Jr. But obviously with all common sense, and if you've got the records in front of you, they've just been operating at two very different levels.
Yeah, I know. And you also think, was it Tyne Booth who we actually had in here, and he did a podcast. But Tyne Booth had Eubank Jr. Okay, not necessarily in trouble, but made him look very, very ordinary. Made him, and you look at fights like that and you think, can he then all of a sudden become this person that we told that he is, this fighter that we told that he is?
Yeah, interesting. Let's spend a bit of time on the heavyweight fight. Obviously, there's been so much talk about Tyson Fury versus X, Y and Z for the last 2 years. He hasn't fought due to the pullouts of David Haye and then Derek Chisora. He's finally going to get in the ring. He's got a giant beard to take him with him. Which he's currently polling on Twitter, whether he shaves or not. Fury Chisora, excited for it, Matt? Because generally they come forward fighters and they will put everything into it, won't they?
Yeah, I'm looking forward to it. I was looking forward to it when it was announced. I think when they first started putting this together, this idea of a Fury Chisora rematch together, I remember going along to a press conference almost a year ago now. So it has been building and building to the point where it's almost crumbled, hasn't it? I thoroughly, the first one was no great advertisement for heavyweight boxing, perhaps certainly for the purist. However, it was not dull. It was an exciting fight, I thought, the first one, even though it was fairly one-sided, but Chisora showed in spurts that he could give Tyson Fury some problems.
Well, the take-home message was that if he was in shape,
yeah,
it could have been a different story.
And I think that we will see Chisora in shape. Fury certainly looks in shape. I think it will be. I think this could surprise a lot of people, and we might be reminded why this was so appealing in the first place, this rematch.
How does Chisora win the fight?
He's got to do... I mean, Fury has been dropped by that overhand right. He struggles when people are inside. He's inside fighting, although it's quite impressive
for
a big man. It is kind of where you would target. I think Chisora's going to do that. He's a decent fighter on the inside, Chisora. He's got to bowl that overhand right, and he's got a rough Fury up as much as possible.
I think he should work the body as well. Get inside there, work the body, and try and take some huff and puff out of Fury's legs.
Yeah, I think what with Chisora is that he's not a dynamite one punch finisher.
Which is what I'm talking about, the body. You know, you think he's got to invest in there to try and slow Fury down.
But I mean, I went to the press conference yesterday and I was trying to judge people's demeanours in terms of their confidence and what have you. And Don Charles and Derek Chisora were very, very quiet for a while, almost to the point where I thought, well, I wonder if something has concerned them, because Don Charles has publicly said on many occasions the lead up and the training and the preparation for fight number one was dreadful. If they get it right this time, there's absolutely no doubt that Chisora will win. Yeah. So I was looking for clues to see whether or not that lead up has gone as well as they'd hoped. But Chisora, ultimately, when he did start talking, he was so, so relaxed. Very, very content in his world. You don't often see that with Chisora. Sometimes you can see a slightly fragile side to him, a slightly insecure side
to him.
He's
experienced now, though, isn't he, Matt? Look at what he's done with Hay and with Vitaly. He's been in some. He's been properly under the microscope several times now.
Yeah, no, I do think he has come on as a fighter, and I think he's come on as a human being as well. I think it's an interesting fight. I think you have to favour Fury. You have to favour Fury. But the thing is with Tyson Fury is that he rarely looks invincible. He's perhaps the most exciting heavyweight in the world. But the reason for that is because he can appear to have several faults. You can hit him. It's not like when Tyson Fury was 10-0, there was nothing like the buzz about Tyson Fury that we've now got about Anthony Joshua, for example.
Yeah, that's true.
So, you know, you would think that Fury will win again. You would think that Fury would win again. It would be a surprise to me if Chisora won.
I think style-wise, the Frankie Gavin Bradley Skeet fight will be a very ugly match and difficult to watch. But there is a sleeper, dare I say, on the undercard, because people are looking at those three main fights. I think Gary Sykes, Liam Walsh could be an absolute belter. What do you think?
Yeah, I really like the look of Sykes, Walsh. I really think that could be the fight of the night for real enjoyment. I mean, I 100% agree with you regards Gavin and Ski. On paper, that could be, you know, that looks like that's going to be a bit of a messy, hard to watch fight. But Frankie Gavin said yesterday because when this fight was first announced, I sensed that Frankie Gavin was overconfident, didn't seem to have that much respect for Bradley Skeet. But yesterday, he said this is the first training camp where we've brought in sparring partners in an effort to replicate what our opponent is going to do, which suggests that there is a lot of respect there. And, you know, let's face it, Frankie Gavin has to take this fight seriously, because if he loses that against Bradley Skeet tomorrow, his career is over, or certainly at the level we thought he would get to.
Yeah, of course. Okay, fair enough. So there's plenty on the line for everybody, everybody in London. There's also a lot going on, well, not a lot, but there's a fair bit going on internationally this weekend. Pick of the action sees Terence Crawford against Ray Beltran. You'll remember Ray Beltran from giving Ricky Burns hell.
Yeah.
And unfortunately for him, losing a very contentious decision on the scorecards, or being awarded a draw rather than a victory. So he believes that the belt that Crawford owns, Crawford obviously then went on to take it off Burns, rightfully belongs to him. So they're settling this dispute for the WBO title in Omaha, Nebraska, where Crawford's become a big star. I previewed that show in the magazine this week. But there's an interesting, I'm not sure what to call it, thing in Russia this weekend, where they have Ruslan Provodnikov against Jose Luis Castillo. Matt, pick a winner.
Ooh. Well, I think Provodnikov, but I wouldn't be surprised. No, I mean, I think I put something in Heroes and Villains a while ago in when that was rumoured, and I just, you know, it's horrible. It's a horrible matchup that we do see now and again in boxing. It would be a massive, massive upset if Castillo hasn't looked right since the Ricky Hammer fight, has he?
2006.
And, I mean, even the fight before that, I think, which was Herman and Gujo, was
it? That's right, yeah. That was his last big win.
He didn't look great then. That was an unconvincing win, I seem to remember. Quite controversial on the scorecards. And, I don't know, so we're going back, what, 8 years? at least 8 years removed from his peak. Tough, long career. And Provodnikov, you sense, will get him out of there. And hopefully, for Castillo's sake, it will be, you know, clean and it will be quick.
Anything else on that, Bill?
Well, there's the one we've all been waiting for. It is quite an astonishing and scary comeback. It really is. I mean, I think we spoke about it briefly in the office, and I thought that surely that's not going to happen. And then this morning I wake up to photographs of, is he 62?
Mickey Rourke weighing in at 61 or 62 to fight in Russia.
And that's not 61 or 62 pounds or whatever, that's 61 or 62 years old. It's just, he looked, to be fair, for a guy that age, he looks in good shape, he looks in good nick. But, you know, surely this is the point where people need saving for themselves.
Yeah.
He was a good fighter in his day, but he was nowhere near world class or anything like that.
What top fighters? I mean, maybe he's been inspired by Bernard Hopkins, but I mean, you know, the fact of the matter is, the best don't operate at the age of 60, and people who never made it certainly shouldn't be. Speaks volumes for what's going on in Russia and how it's run there that a bill that can be headlined by Provodnikov Castillo, whose best days were lightweight 12 or 13 years ago, how that fight is atop of the bill, let alone how Mickey Rourke somehow got onto the bill too. Travesty, I think, is one word to sum it up. On a positive side though, John Denham was in Macau last week, and that's not positive for us in the office because he was over there. But Manny Pacquiao was back, and now I suppose more positively than anything, he's actually making some noise about a Floyd Mayweather fight, because, you know, they've almost sort of refused to comment about each other over the last couple of years, but he's sort of cranked the pressure up a little bit. We've had a press release from the WBC calling for it today. Oscar De La Hoya has tweeted about it this week, saying he's offering the biggest guarantees in history of boxing to make it happen. Matt, is it going to happen?
Yeah. Yeah, it is.
When? Pick a date.
It's going to happen in May.
May 2015?
Yeah.
Good.
Yeah. Yeah.
Why so confident?
No. In all truthfulness, how can anyone be confident that this fight is going to happen, really? But I've kind of changing tact and thinking positive about things. I think for the first time since this was, you know, this became the most appealing matchup in boxing, which I think, back in 2008, 2009, we just presumed it would happen. It just seemed unthinkable that it wouldn't, because it was that appealing. Since then, there's been a lot of blame on either side for why it didn't happen. But this is the first time for me where I'm thinking now, since those days, where I am thinking, actually, this could happen. All parties, bar Mayweather at this stage, that could put this fight together and making the right noises.
The one person who'd probably be the most disappointed is Amir Khan, who wants to fight both of them. In fact, he wants to fight Mayweather in May and Pacquiao at the end of the year. And maybe even squeezing Kell Brook. That was based on a chat we had on Monday night. Yeah, an interview that we did on Monday night.
That's an ambitious projection, but I don't know. I mean, if somebody walks in now with the loaded gun and puts it to your head or whatever, you would probably say no, it won't happen, because that's just the history of.
Are you talking Mayweather Pacquiao?
Yeah, sorry. Oh. Yeah. Because that's what happened, and you still. But I'm tired now. I mean, Mayweather posted again this week, didn't he, on Twitter or whatever, you know, a little montage of Pacquiao getting knocked out. Did he do that about Maidana? Did he do?
No, he tries to talk all those guys up.
Exactly. So all these guys, with Alvarez the exception, you know, the majority of the guys he's fought in the last few years have lost. You know, so his kind of argument that the Pacquiao has been beaten and this, that, and the other is a dreadful, dreadful reason.
Yeah.
for his current stance. However, it wouldn't surprise me, and let's face it, Mayweather, I do believe that deep down he wants to be the best that he can be. And I do believe that money could ultimately make this happen.
They've both shown signs of slippage, be it here and there, or be it for an odd performance or such. But who slipped the most, and why is it a good time to have the fight? I mean, I've listed why it's a bad time to have a fight in the column this week. Why is it a good time to have this fight?
I think it's because you mentioned there they've slipped. So yeah, we're never going to get 2009 back again. But the 2014 versions of Manny Pacquiao and Floyd Mayweather are still, for me, probably the best two fighters in boxing. And they've slipped, I would say, at similar levels. The thing going against Pacquiao, obviously, is that loss to that loss we mentioned to Marquez. But I don't think it's been quite such a devastating defeat that we all thought it would be at the time. I think Pacquiao, although he hasn't been that terrifying destroyer that blazed through Miguel Cotto, that knocked Ricky Hatton out cold, he's not that fighter, but he has adapted his style a little bit, and he's into the fact that he's getting older. And the same with Mayweather as well. As much as you might say, yeah, I'm just giving you fans what you want, as to why we've seen a few more exciting offerings from Mayweather recently, I still think this has got, for the style of both of them and where they are in the sport, it is a huge, huge, hugely appealing contest.
Okay. John's report from Macau is in this week's issue. There's plenty of interesting stuff in there. Obviously, the bill was topped by Pacquiao against Chris Algieri. Also featured the likes of Lomachenko, Jesse Vargas, Antonio DeMarco, Zhu Shiming, and others. Some really good stuff. Matt, you're up in Liverpool. Let's spend some time on this, because there's been a lot of talk about the Liverpool show, good, bad, ugly, and everywhere in between this week. Liverpool, talk to me.
All right, it was... Undercard was fairly enjoyable, I thought. I thought it was all right. I mean, okay.
You're giving it 3 stars in the main.
Yeah, I thought it was all right. I mean, from my perspective, I thought it was a 3-star undercard. I thought the main event was hugely disappointing.
Which you've given 2 stars.
Yeah, which ultimately, it had to be judged against the pay-per-view platform it was on, and it didn't deliver. You have to. It's all well and good saying, well, you know, but yeah, the undercard had some big names and this, that, and the other. The bottom line is that people who watch that on television had to pay for it. They had to pay more on top of their Sky subscription. And in my opinion, it didn't deliver value for money.
Okay. How did you see the main event? I'm not talking scorecards, but how did you see it going? Sort of break it down for me a little bit.
I thought Cleverley started well. I thought he was quicker. He was more accurate, I thought, anyway, from my perspective. And then I had Cleverley ahead at the halfway mark. Fight was kind of up in the air. And I thought at that point, about the halfway mark, it could still have been a good fight. And then it all changed. And Cleverley was exhausted. And it became quite a dull encounter. Who'd you blame for that? I don't know. And I kind of, you know, I do completely take Eddie Hearn's comments on board, in that we can't control that. Absolutely, absolutely not. And I also take his comments on board that if that fight had been really, really good fight, say after round 6 it had caught fire, and they'd both been going hell for leather for the last 6 rounds, it was a fantastic spectacle, you walked away thinking, wow, I really enjoyed that, this whole event would have a completely different feel to it. It really would. The fact that the undercard was quite predictable would have been forgiven, I think. I think if you had a sense of real enjoyment about that, then I think a lot would have been forgiven. But ultimately, you know, through no fault of anyone's, or you can't really pin the blame on anyone, it didn't deliver because the main event didn't deliver.
Interesting. Anthony Joshua went past Michael Sprott. I think I was saying last week we couldn't get odds or any decent odds on a round one finish. Predictably, that was over in how many seconds? 86 seconds. Would have fancied that as a first round job. Shame, yeah. You know, it's a shame to see Michael Sprott like that, because 10, 15 years ago he was given some really good fighters, very, very tough nights. Certainly no match for Anthony Joshua as he is today. Impressed with Joshua? In the flesh? Been there ringside?
Yeah, I mean, I think that's the third fight I've seen Joshua. And yeah, I am. You can't not be impressed with him. I'm not sold. I'm not completely sold on Anthony Joshua just yet, because we just don't know. We just don't know. How many times have we had heavyweight prospects come along and they look sensational for the first 20 fights of their career, and then all of a sudden we find something out. An opponent comes along who teaches us something that this guy isn't quite the real deal. All good. Joshua, he could not have scripted it better so far. I think his level of opposition has been sensible. Perhaps this was a slight backward step.
Do you think in some ways it's a blessing in disguise what happened to David Price happened for Joshua? Do you think they will chance their arm less having seen what happened to Price?
Would
you just think that was just a complete anomaly where the wrong opponent was brought in, the wrong style, wrong size, everything?
Yeah, it was. It was a bizarre opponent choice, wasn't it, for David Price? That no, I think that Joshua will be moved along probably fairly quickly. I think the Kevin Johnson fight in January at this moment in time is just what he needs. If he walks through Kevin Johnson in one or two rounds, then that's a massive, massive statement.
You just flipping around the undercard, Callum Smith, there's so much, such a buzz around Liverpool about young Callum Smith. Impressed about his win against Serge Locker?
I was really impressed with the way Callum Smith went about it. What I like about Callum Smith, and I noticed it quite some time ago when he was after his first or second fight, is that he fights with a patience that belies his age and belies his experience. And he'll find gaps in the tightest of defences. There's not a punch wasted. It's so intelligent, his boxing. And there were times in this fight where he looked like he might get his opponent out there. I think it was the fourth round, I can't remember, where he really, really targeted the body, and it looked like he might be able to stop him. But he seemed content to go the distance, and that's exactly the fight that he needed. He looked as strong in the 12th as he did in the opening round. And full credit to Callum Smith. I really, really like the look of Callum Smith. For me, he could go all the way.
Scott Quigg and Jamie McDonald were supposed to have almost gimmies, more gimmies, people might say, given how they got the titles and everything else. Politics aside, they had their hands full with Javier Chacon and Otaki, respectively. But I just wanted to talk a little bit about the super middleweights, George Groves, James DeGale. I mean, one thing about when you talk about pay-per-view and value for money is, personally, going into the fight, I thought James DeGale would have had a very hard night with Peraban.
Yeah.
For me, that gave me more value for money, because it's a weird one, isn't it? I was massively impressed by James DeGale, so therefore, in terms of value, I probably felt like I had more value from that than I did him struggling against a lesser opponent. So I suppose what I'm getting at is that I felt it was great to see DeGale take out someone like Peraban, who'd given Beaker a hard fight, who was a decent fighter, and I thought he was going to struggle. It was a pleasant surprise, I suppose. And if you get a pleasant surprise, then it's not a bad thing. But that going into the fight, I think that's one of the fights where when you look to grade the undercard, you could say, well, actually, that fight's going to be quite decent because De Gea hasn't proved he's, by any stretch, an elite fighter or anything like that. And Peribane has given some good world-class fighters a very, very tough night. So therefore, on paper, it was a good fight.
Yeah, no, I completely agree with you. And, you know, that's credit to De Gea completely in the way that he went about business there. And kind of going back to the whole undercard thing, I genuinely, hand on heart, thought as a pay-per-view undercard, it was more than acceptable. As an undercard in its own, it was more than acceptable. There was no point where I was bored or anything like that. Say that had been the undercard for, I don't know, David Haye against Tyson Fury, for example. You'd have no qualms.
Frotch Groves.
Yeah, you'd have no qualms with it. And De Gea Peribane ultimately was, on paper, like you say, perhaps the most competitive of those undercard fights. But De Gea looked brilliant, and I remember. I think it was when he fought Paul Smith, and I remember being there for that and thinking, yeah, Jones De Gea can, you know, his potential is almost limitless. I was thinking pound for pound, I was thinking he really is going to be a superstar worldwide. Not saying I got that feeling after watching him beat Peribane, but it's the first time where I've really thought, actually, yeah.
It reminded you what he could do.
Yeah, exactly.
It's interesting to see his potential, very interesting to gauge it. Obviously, we're 6 years on from the Olympics in 2008, which is astonishing. You know, a lot of people are, many of the Olympians who are successful win a world title in 4 years or less these days. But he's possibly heading in a different direction to George Groves, who, for me, is starting to look a bit fatigued and a little bit, not shot-worn, not disinterested, I'm just trying to think, doesn't look like he's quite firing on all cylinders at the minute. He struggled with Dennis Duggan, for me, lost a couple of rounds, toiled when he didn't have to, sometimes was looking for single shots to get the job done. I don't know, I think he needs a break. Not a long break, but a break where he needs to just go away, forget about it for 3 or 4 months, come back refreshed.
Yeah, no, completely. He doesn't look quite right, and despite all the words saying no, the loss to Carl Froch didn't affect me, I just got caught by a lucky punch and this, that and the other. Those kind of knockouts affect people. Manny Steward, I remember saying that he would always advise fighters that have been on the wrong end of a knockout like that to walk away from the game for 12 months if possible. Not just for the health aspects, but just to get their mind in a situation where it's not so fresh. The fact that they've been knocked spark out isn't so fresh. And I agree, I think Groves, he didn't look tired, he didn't look worn out, but he does need to step away from it, because he's fought twice now since the Froch knockout. I mean, but also in his defence, I don't know who was doing the matchmaking for this fight, but I don't know whose bright idea it was to plug Dennis Duggan out of obscurity and plonk him in there with George Groves. It's kind of, I don't know, the reward of fighting an awkward, crude, brawling southpaw. It was unknown, was minimal, but the risk, it turned out, was pretty high. But he dealt with him. He had some issues in the first 5 rounds. Then he seemed to figure him out. Then he went about his business, and then he stopped him. So, you know, he should get credit. He should get credit for emerging victorious in an unexpectedly difficult fight.
Okay. Amir Khan against Devin Alexander has found its way onto Sky Sports. We talk about the pay-per-view side of things. And have done for several weeks now, I suppose. Obviously, it could be seen as a direct correlation between Sky put on a big pay-per-view and then all of a sudden they buy a big night of boxing. That could, for some, indicate that they're looking to reinvest the money into overseas fights. You don't know, maybe they're, obviously, it could be that they're looking to Khan Mayweather for next year and another box office night. It's hard to know exactly what the direction will be, but if they are reinvesting the money, then that's obviously good news for fight fans, or certainly fight fans who are Sky subscribers as well. But I don't know. Do you know what? What I found interesting about the Liverpool show, and I did watch in the end, I know last week I said I was debating about getting the pay-per-view. Well, technically I didn't. I went to a friend's house and he got the pay-per-view. But I watched with a load of casual fans, and you know, we keep hearing this conversation across different areas of boxing, social media, websites, and in the office, where people talk about hardcore fans and casual fans. To watch that bill with casual fans was actually really interesting. They thought that the Scott Quigg fight was brilliant. You know, the way that they were describing it was like it was Ward Gatti. Yet they were disappointed with De Gael Peribán, which obviously is probably the most impressive fight of the night. And yet they loved Michael Sprott, Joshua. They thought that was a great fight because they wanted the knockout. They wanted a clean finish. So it was weird, and they weren't too fussed either way about the main event. So it was interesting to watch it with those casual fans, because those are the guys who don't normally watch boxing but did watch it on the night. One thing I did just want to touch upon, because I've had a couple of letters about it, and there was some interesting comment on the night. For me, and again, I don't want to take anything away from James De Gea, I thought it was an outstanding performance, the best of his career, better than the Gonzalez win in May. But I did think Howard Foster jumped the gun with the stoppage, Matt. Where were you with that, and how clear was your line of sight?
Yeah, it was. It was premature, but it was understandable. I mean, I wasn't, when it was waved off, I wasn't like, wow, that was too early. That was too early. I just think with Peribán's, particularly with his reputation for durability in mind, the fact that he was back up on his feet, he didn't look like he was gone. He didn't look like he was out there. He should have been, in an ideal world, allowed to continue, but I didn't think it was a bad stoppage, and so, unfortunately for Howard Foster, his name will probably forever be linked to Froch Groves 1, but to compare it to that stoppage, I didn't think there's no comparison.
Right, interesting. Okay. All right, Matt. Well, look, it's been great to have your thoughts and opinions again, as always. Guys, there's so much in the magazine this week. We've got a guest column with none other than Bob Arum. There's stuff from Antonio Tarver. There's, on the website, there's plenty from the fallout from Liverpool. I've done long exclusives with Tony Bellew and Nathan Cleverley, who was brilliant and forthright in defeat against Sergey Kovalev, when I did a Q&A with him for the web after that defeat. And he's been very candid once more, although nowhere near as down as he was after the Kovalev fight. Matt's done a very long and interesting piece with Eddie Hearn. He's really stuck Eddie Hearn with some of the hard questions there. In fact, Eddie Hearn, to the extent where he phoned me up the day afterwards and said that Matt certainly wasn't letting him off the hook. So there's some cracking stuff there. And obviously there's big reports from Macau, Liverpool, and we look ahead to Bad Blood. It's one of the big issues of the year, guys. So either download it from iTunes now, or go out and grab one if you can find one on the newsstand. But thanks a lot for joining us. I'll try and be back with John Dennon in the interim. If not, you'll be joining us again next week, I hope. Thanks a lot, and we'll speak to you soon.